The words we live by. The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations present The Words We Live By, the summer series of the Eternal Light program, which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Today we present the 12th in this series of 15 literary dialogues on love, human and divine, featuring two of America's foremost men of letters, Maurice Samuel and Professor Mark Van Doren.
Mark, I'm glad we've got behind us what I called last week the tragic or disastrous loves of the Bible.
Well, they were interesting, Maurice.
Yes, but they were heavy going for me. They're dispiriting. And we're coming now into broad and shining uplands. We're coming to what I consider, and perhaps you do too, the loveliest of the love stories in the Bible, although it is the love between two women and constitutes perhaps the most famous or nearly the most famous personal episode in all biblical literature.
Well, now, wait a minute, Maurice. Yes, it is about the love of two women. It is also, it may be that we shall disagree about this, is it also about the love of a woman and a man, Ruth and Boaz?
Ruth and Boaz. Well,
we'll reserve the question.
Yes, but since you've introduced it in this fashion, I can see we probably will disagree.
All right.
But for the moment, let's go ahead with the Ruth-Naomi relation. You will admit that it is more significant, has taken hold of the world's imagination much more strongly than the relationship between Ruth and Boaz.
Oh, yes, there's no question about that. Anyone asked to remember the Book of Ruth remembers the famous moment when Naomi is asking her daughters-in-law to return home, and Ruth refuses. It is merely that later on, I think we shall have something to talk about in connection with the other relation that develops when the two women return to Israel. However, I quite agree.
You know, I called writing about Ruth and Naomi, I called it an idyll of old age. Now I also think of it as the great example of love in bereavement, how sorrow bound two women together in an everlasting love which has become, one might say, the symbol for all human beings, how a disaster is the prelude to an abiding relationship.
Do we need to remind anyone, Maurice, of what happened before the story begins? Namely, years ago, Naomi had left her country, her people, and gone to the land of the Moabites. And there her two sons, her husband had died, and her two sons had died, and she was left there only with her daughters-in-law. And now it is time to come home, empty, as she says. And the story virtually begins, with the description of the beginning of the journey home.
Yes, there's reason to read and reread those immortal words as one sings a melody. The fact that they're well known is no reason for not repeating them. Those words that Naomi addressed to Ruth, asking her to return, and the words that Ruth uttered, "Entreat me not to leave thee, and to return from following after thee. For whither thou goest, I will go, and where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God my God. Where thou diest will I die, and there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me, and more also, if aught but death part thee and me." Marvelous words, and I must advert again to the fact that in Hebrew they are incomparably more compact, even than in the admittedly marvelous English.
Can you read them in Hebrew?
Yes,
I'd like to hear them.
Let me read them. Vatomar Rut. And Ruth said, "Al tifgi'i bi la'azvech la'shuv me'achrayich, ki al asher telchi elech, uba'asher talini alin, amech ami ve'elohayich elohay, ba'asher tamuti amut, B'sham akaber, ko ya'aseh Adonai li b'ho yusif ki amavet yafrid b'ini u'benech. You notice it's much shorter in the Hebrew. You have two words, for example. Thy people shall be my people consists of two words in Hebrew. One is thy people. That's one word. My people is another word. Thy people, my people. It's a highly contracted form, and it has the immediate effect of piercing you with its intensity.
I don't know, to be sure, about that. It could be that the ultimate effect in English is the same. Thy people and my people, they are four words only technically, it seems to me.
The others are binding words.
Well, they have the effect.
Intermediary words.
Well, that doesn't matter. I was very interested to hear it in Hebrew. I'm reminded of an experience I've often had with persons who ask for advice about how they might learn how to write stories, short stories particularly, but stories of any sort. And I've always advised them not to bother too much with the rules, with books and teachers who would undertake to tell them how to do this. I said, for instance, this thing called characterization is all nonsense. If you remember that one of the most famous persons in all story characterized herself just by one speech she made.
Yes.
And nothing else needs to be said about the woman who could say that.
What you say strikes me as very cogent.
Now, I'm speaking to you as a novelist, incidentally. Do you agree?
Yes. That can happen. Yet I would ask you this question. Doesn't the Book of Ruth and the incident of Ruth and Naomi gather from its background and its surroundings and implications much warmth? Admittedly, that speech alone could be an immortal thing. One could find it as a fragment of a poem and say, some great person spoke that. Nevertheless, the effect of the whole Book of Ruth is compounded from a number of circumstances. Let's say the following are some. That this is the story of the coming together of two peoples who are often represented as being hostile to each other.
Oh, yeah.
The Moabites and the Israelites. It is also a marvelous little episode, peaceful, pastoral, interpolated, episodic, in the midst of the very bloody book of Judges. We are told of the book of Judges in one spot, every man did that which was good in his own eyes. There was no rulership, no continuous rulership, which was what led to the establishment of a monarchy. And in the midst of all this tumult, this rushing back and forth of armies, we see that a quiet life in a little town went on, and a lovely, idyllic incident took place. All of that seems to me contributory to the immense effect of the Book of Ruth, without derogating from what you've said.
Well, yes, of course. We're reminded, by the way, that in all times of trouble among any people, the view that the reader of the history of that people takes is that there was turmoil everywhere and all the time. But only common sense can tell us that there must have been times and places where there was no turmoil. And so here there is this little pool of peace. The Book of Ruth, I'm glad you reminded me of this, begins by saying, and it came to pass in the days when the judges judged. In other words, this was in the time of Jephthah and Samson and those people who had those terrible and bloody experiences. This, however, as you say, is entirely personal and pastoral and domestic.
It reminds us that life went on. The weaving of the creative side of life, which lies in these things and not in the battles and in the ambitions of generals and princes. It also makes me think of the distorted picture we get very often from satirists and even from prophets. There's a remark in Dill, you know, on Roman history. He said that if Juvenal said about life in Rome was anywhere near his description, the whole of that society would have collapsed. And if life in Judea was anything like what the prophets described it, a sinful nation and sick from head to foot and all the rest of it, that people wouldn't have lasted a year, let alone several centuries. So that here, this is a reminder of the continuity of normal, good, loving people in the midst of very dreadful things and very destructive things.
You know, the story of Ruth is famous, among other things, for its brevity. All the things that you've been saying apply. But there are things that we say after we have been penetrated by the arrow of this tale. You notice how the storyteller says, after this wonderful speech of Ruth to Naomi, this is all that is said about the journey from that point on, back to Israel. And when she saw, that is to say, when Naomi saw, that she, that is to say Ruth, was steadfastly minded to go with her, she left off speaking unto her. So they two went until they came to Bethlehem. There's no discussion, no description of the journey.
Yeah. A novelist would have taken advantage of the fact that this is a wild country and have given you all of the solemn effect of, very skillfully no doubt, the solemn effect of the mountainous areas and the caves and whatnot and the crossing of the Jordan. And it's all gone here.
And the rising of the sun and the setting of the sun. And the...
And their reflections and meditations and throwbacks.
Yes.
He'd have made a Hollywood business of it.
Yes, the wonderful thing about it is that nothing like that is done. Once this speech is made, which is the only thing that matters...
In fact, when Hollywood gets hold of a Bible story, all it does is to tell you how good the Bible is if you go back to it.
I read a book not long ago called Ruth. There have been several novels based on this little tale. And as you say, the author was skillful and ingenious at realizing matters that are only implied here. But no amount of realization, it seems to me, sufficed. I preferred to do the realizing myself, as people always have.
You mentioned just a moment ago, Mark, the brevity of the book. There are two short books, both of them very powerful, which have made a great impression on the Western world, the Book of Ruth and the Book of Jonah. There are shorter books among the prophets, Nahum and Habakkuk and Zephaniah. They're shorter, but they have the effect, they make the effect of being fragments.
I was going to say that.
Whereas these are absolutely perfect. This is a whole world presented in, if I may use the phrase, in a gigantic miniature.
You know, the account of their arrival, for that matter, is marvelous, too, for its brevity, and yet for its fullness. And it came to pass, when they were come to Bethlehem, that all the city was astir concerning them. And the women said, "Is this Naomi?" And she said to them, "Call me not Naomi, call me Mara, for the Almighty hath dealt very bitterly with me. I went out full, and the Lord hath brought me back home empty. Why call ye me Naomi, seeing the Lord hath testified against me, and the Almighty hath afflicted me?" So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, with her, who returned out of the field of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem in the beginning of barley harvest.
Yes, that's the cutoff, as it were, is perfectly done.
And they came to Bethlehem in the time of
the barley harvest. Yes. You've noticed, Mark, how the book insistently, repeatedly, refers to Ruth as the Moabitess.
Yes.
Always reminding the reader, this woman is a Moabitess, as though the author had it in mind. Now, you don't forget that this is not a story just of two women. It is a story of two women of different peoples, of different groups, which were always... are nearly always hostile, and look how they built up between them an everlasting story of love. I am quite certain that the author, the editors, had this in mind, and it is, for me, one of the instances of the struggle that went on perpetually in the Jewish people, in the Israelites, between contending impulses. One, the narrow provincial and particularist impulse, and the one which was later to triumph and become characteristic of what we call normative Judaism, the universalist one. They were always lapsing into the egotism of being a chosen people in the wrong sense, and striving for, through their prophets and through literature of this kind, for the big vision of being chosen not as a privilege and as a concession to their ego, but being more a choosing people than a chosen people, treading the wide path of the universal approach to mankind. This is what I read into this persistent Ruth the Moabites.
Yeah.
Afterwards, when Boaz presents himself before the little town and says, I'm taking Ruth the Moabites to wife, it's Ruth the Moabites. Always the insistence on these two peoples.
Well, now that you speak of Boaz, Maurice, let's argue, if we have to, over the question of whether the Book of Ruth is not equally the love story of Ruth and Boaz and the love story of Ruth and Naomi. No word of love is spoken anywhere.
That's
in the book.
Yes. I noticed that I checked on it because I wanted to talk about it. The word love is not mentioned.
Yes, but
of course it needn't be.
No, let me say, neither was it spoken in the case of Naomi and Ruth. Ruth merely says, I will follow you wherever you go, and your God will be my God. I shall dwell where you dwell. And we hear later that Naomi... It is not said that Naomi then understood that Ruth loved her. She merely understood that she was never going to be able to persuade this girl to go back. So, just as there's no word of love spoken between the two women, there's no word of love spoken between the woman and the man, and yet, to me, it is one of the most interesting of love stories.
Well, let's look at the
text. I mean the story of Ruth and Boaz.
Well, examining this question, let's look at the text. You remember, of course, that there was some sort of managerial play there, that there wasn't a chance meeting between them except as Boaz saw her in the field and was very much moved, told her, I've heard what you did, how you came back with your mother-in-law, and he called her my daughter,
yeah.
From which we gather he was an older man, perhaps it never occurred to him that there would ever be an intimate relationship between them.
Perhaps.
The fact is that old Naomi had to call upon an ancient custom whereby a young woman could appeal to the leading relative, surviving relative of family, and on the harvest night when they all slept in the fields, she came to him. She went down unto the threshing floor, we read, and did according to all that her mother-in-law bade her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk, and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of corn. And she came softly and uncovered his feet and laid her down. And it came to pass at midnight that the man was startled and turned himself, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. And he said, Who art thou? And she answered, I am Ruth, thy handmaid. Spread therefore thy skirt over thy handmaid, for thou art a near kinsman. And he said, Blessed be thou of the Lord, my daughter. Thou hast shown more kindness in the end than at the beginning, inasmuch as thou didst not follow the young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, fear not. I will do to thee all that thou sayest. She hadn't said anything, of course.
Well,
all that thou sayest, or I suppose all that you imply.
Yes.
By all the men,
merely by being there.
Yes, for all the men in the gate of my people do know that thou art a virtuous woman. And then he goes on to say, I will do the part of a kinsman to thee.
And
there is affection there.
No, wait a minute. I think there's more than that. You remember, Naomi had put Ruth up to everything that she did. Once the two women returned, Ruth assumes a passive role, as indeed she had assumed a passive role in the beginning. She was utterly in the hands of Naomi. She placed herself in her hands, as she will later place herself in the hands, or if you please, literally, at the feet of Boaz. Ruth has the courage to do what Naomi tells her, but it's not clear that she would have had the courage to do anything by herself. Naomi plans the whole thing. Once she hears, after Ruth returns that first day, that she has found herself among the reapers and the gleaners of Boaz. It seems to be clear to Naomi that this is an opportunity. And she gives Ruth explicit directions about that evening on the threshing floor. And I have always been especially interested in what she says when Ruth returns that second time and tells her that Boaz had been kind to her and let her sleep under his robe at his feet and had given her barley to bring home to her mother-in-law. I think that excites Naomi. I don't think the word is too strong. She says, "Then said she," that's say Naomi, "sit still, my daughter, until thou know how the matter will fall. For the man will not rest until he hath finished
this day.
In other words, I know what is happening. In other words, Boaz did not need to do all that he did. He could have been merely polite and distant, formal. He could have been courteous to her. I think she interested him a great deal, as she interests you and me, every reader. It's one of the mysteries of love stories, how it is that the reader of them becomes convinced that someone in the love story is lovable. You know how we want persons in love stories to fall in love with one another. What does the storyteller do in order to make us have that desire? Because our desire is just as strong as theirs. So we are for Ruth. We think she's beautiful. She's never called beautiful, by the way.
No.
She's merely called good.
Yes.
Although goodness is one, I suppose, maybe the supreme form of beauty.
Yes, it radiates the features as a rule.
Yes, now here we are given, I think, and I'm not trying, I don't think I'm reading too much into this, we're given to understand that Boaz looked at this strange girl who had suddenly come among his people, asked who she was, kept on looking at her, kept saying to himself, everything that she does is good, everything that she does is comely. And he does these favors to her. He sees to it that she is safe among the women rather than among the men who might molest her. And he sees to it, as a matter of fact, he goes to the trouble to say to the women, leave a few things, leave a few pieces of grain about for her to pick up. Help her out, in other words, do everything for her. And then he does all this for her. He didn't need to do that. When he was disturbed in the night by her presence, he could have said, I am disturbed. Yes. So you are doing too much.
Perhaps, Mark, it may be that one of the reasons that I see this not as primarily a love story, although it is something full of good affection.
By the way, I'm not saying primarily.
Let me say, the reason I play it down, at least in comparison with you, is my vision of it as being some great, they're being involved in a great drama. You know, the Jewish belief that the Messiah, who will be descended from David, will therefore be descended from Ruth and Boaz.
Yes.
So that there is here...
So Jesse and David are descendants of their child.
Yes. So that there is here an intimation of more than human relationships, which gives it a solemnity, which, I won't say drowns out, but like a larger strain of music, subdues the individual melody.
Well, now, Maurice...
Let me go on for a moment. There's a remarkable passage which... on which I lean for this, historic choreographic effect,
yes.
You might say.
Yes, I understand.
So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and he went in unto her, and the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. And the woman said unto Naomi, blessed be the Lord, who hath not left thee this day without any kinsman, and let his name be famous in Israel. See, there is already an intimation of... a grand theme in which these two loving people, Boaz and Ruth, stand at the center of something greater than themselves.
Well, now, Maurice, I'm not denying the great dimension of this story. And in the whole context of the Bible, that dimension is clear and terribly important. I'm merely saying that the Bible is the great book that we say it is, because we don't have merely grandeur here. You see, I can imagine a book written by persons who did not have the genius to blend both grandeur and...
Intimacy. Yes.
You see, everything that you say is true about the whole tenor of this tale, about the whole meaning of it. Yes, it looks forward and backward, and as we've been saying, too, it has as its context the terrible time of the judges, and the peace of it is eloquent because of the contrast. And yet the writers did not fail to make it naturally right. Also, they did not fail to give it that warmth and that particularity and that intimacy which would save it from being just inflated and empty grandeur. The book, as you and I know ever very well because we've been saying it for years, this book is both grand and true. It would not seem as true to all the people who have read it, I think, if it were nothing but grand gestures and the drawing of huge, broad outlines.
Yes.
Whenever we enter it, we find something which fascinates us.
This blend, it's the choral blend of the individual and the historic, like a melody against a background of woodwind and brass.
That's right.
Again, it appears in the passage preceding the one I've just read to you, when Boaz stands in front of the people at the gate, and he says, "Moreover, Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of Mahlon, have I acquired to be my wife, to raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance, that the name of the dead be not cut off from among his brethren and from among the gate of his place. Ye are witnesses this day." And all the people that were in the gate and the elder said, "We are witnesses. The Lord make the woman that is come into thy house like Rachel and like Leah, which two did build the house of Israel. And do thou worthily in Ephrat and be famous in Bethlehem, and let thy house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore unto Judah, of the seed which the Lord shall give thee of this young woman." There's a grandeur there I don't say forbids, but makes one forget the undoubted tenderness, the kindness of the relationship, lifts it into something almost cosmic.
Yes, but when you say lifts it...
The thing is there.
It is there. For instance, when Boaz says to this girl, we're not told what she thinks of him, it is quite possible that up to some point, maybe after the story ends, up to some point, Ruth is nothing except the obedient daughter-in-law. She's doing just what Naomi had told her to do, and she is looking for a husband, to put it all too simply. But Boaz is touched by the fact that she is here, that she has not followed the young man.
Yes, I've often pondered on what the relationship was between them afterwards, whether it had the domestic sweetness of the incident we're going to discuss next week in the story of Tobit.
Just heard The Words We Live By, the 12th in the 15-week Eternal Light summer series. Be with us again next week when Maurice Samuel and Professor Mark Van Doren will resume their discussion of love, human and divine. The Words We Live By is produced under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This pre-recorded program has been an NBC Public Affairs presentation. Next, monitor news on the hour on NBC Radio.